Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program today, GDP's surprise rebound puts the Reserve Bank under fresh pressure on rates announcement day. South African banks show resilience, but risks still loom over the economy. Recycling Week exposes South Africa's serious landfill crisis. And can local AI startups really crack the country's unemployment challenge? It's Thursday, the 18th of September. South Africa's inflation unexpectedly cooling to 3.3% in August, just ahead of the Reserve Bank's policy meeting, with the bank's new anchor at 3%. Growth surprising on the upside and markets weighing the debt burden. The MPC, I think, faces a tough call. Well, let's try and make some sense of that. And joining me is Vishal Rama, who is a quantitative analyst at Prescient Investment Management. Vishal, a very warm welcome to you. So as I mentioned, inflation now at 3.3%, close to the bank's new anchor. Does this give the MPC a little more breathing room, or is that 3% target still out of reach?
Thanks for having me, Jeremy. For sure, right? I mean, 3% anchor, I mean, it probably is still within reach. I think it is trending lower. And if we look at the expectations from the SARB and what they've said, is that going forward, inflation is sort of going to be around this 3.5% level over the next while, which will mean that, you know, they are within their target, within the 3% band level, which they are targeting. So for sure, right? I think it does give them scope to be cutting rates. Look, rates with are quite restrictive, and our expectations are that going forward that they should be cutting rates, and which we think they will do at on Thursday's meeting.
But given the cautious nature of the Reserve Bank, that's not, of course, a given, is it?
For sure, right? I think, you know, they, at the back of their mind, they will be concerned around inflationary pressures that are out there. You know, that can always rear itself up, and then the 3% target becomes unhinged in some sense. But as I mentioned, the expectations are that inflation will be under control. I think further to this is, you know, we have the FOMC meeting late this evening, which will also give direction in terms of global trends and how things are panning out there, right? So if things are, you know, the expectations are that the FOMC, the Fed, will be cutting rates, which sort of maybe encourages and gives some room for the SARB to be not as hawkish as they like to be, but to sort of maybe go ahead and cut.
But it's interesting, you know, because globally, and obviously we wait to see what emerges out of Washington tonight, but globally, peers are starting to ease. The Fed is a little cautious, but let's see what happens. But I wonder whether South Africa is aligned to global trends or perhaps a little out of step.
For sure. I think, look, I mean, if you look at the general history and the past, generally speaking, we sort of, I mean, the SARB will never sort of officially say this, but I mean, sort of fairly closely follow that of what the FOMC, the Fed, do. I think, yes, we saw at the previous meeting, it wasn't quite aligned, but generally speaking, we do follow that trend. And I think by not cutting at tomorrow's meeting, you know, if they do not cut, then it sort of puts us a little bit on the back step. So I think it does encourage them. But look, on the other side, as you mentioned at the start, you know, inflation is something that might be at the back of their minds, which might mean that they don't end up cutting at the meeting.
Of course, there's the argument that our policy right now is just too tight for such a fragile economy. And it's all a question of how much growth, I guess, the SARB is willing to sacrifice for its own credibility.
For sure, right? I mean, as mentioned, you know, definitely rates are really restrictive. You know, if you look at the repo right now, which is sitting at 7%, we then look at your inflation expectations, which are around 3%. So the market has sort of tried to take into account what the SARB have sort of announced now by bringing that inflation target lower from 4.5% to 3%. Obviously, it hasn't been passed through legislation, so that'll still taking place, but the market is sort of confident that 3% target will be met. So if we take that 7% less that inflation expectation, so we get a 4%. This is quite stifling on the economy, not really great. You know, it's a bit too high, and I think that definitely does give them scope to be cutting and to be less restrictive in their rates.
But they will also take some comfort, I guess, from Q2 GDP surprising us at 0.8%. Is that enough, though, to suggest real momentum or maybe just a blip?
Yeah, I think your latter blip part probably makes the more sense. Look, it's just one number. The absolute numbers are fairly are very low in the South African economy. I mean, 0.8, that is not sort of conducive and sort of to change the minds of investors and I guess the monetary policy to sort of say cool, South Africa is on the right trajectory. You know, if we see continuous prints which are showing that positive trend over the next while, then yes, that'll be great and will sort of encourage and change the perception around the SA. But definitely, you know, the growth within SA is not where it should be. I would say it probably is a blip. We need to see sustained numbers that are shifting in the right direction for us to say cool. We are definitely moving in the right direction. But having said that, I think going forward, you know, if we continue to see prints, you know, the SARB will get definitely be more encouraged and it definitely does help them with how they decide their policy stance.
Let's assume there is a cut. Is there a risk of capital flight?
Look, they probably, I mean, if there is a cut, I don't expect there to be massive capital flight out of South Africa. You know, we watch quite closely what foreigners are doing, and on the margin, they have actually, you know, they haven't really been participating in our markets. So, with rates being sort of cut lower, you know, if that does happen, we don't expect a lot to move out. You know, at the same time, the expectation is that the Fed will be cutting rates on their side by 25 or 50 bips, depending. So, it's sort of negates itself out. So definitely do not expect that much capital flight, if anything, to come if there is a cut at our meeting.
And Vishal, what kind of signals do we take from bonds carrying some of the highest yields in emerging markets? What do you read into that? Is that confidence in policy or maybe a warning about bigger sovereign risk?
So yeah, I mean, maybe take a step back. So bonds over the last year have done really well, right? So we've seen levels of around 11, 11.5%. We're seeing now at around 10%. That is about a 1.5% compression in yields. This has been really great. Most of that, I mean, obviously the global environment, but one of the factors that have driven that is, you know, the new inflation expectation target of around 3%. So bonds have rallied quite well. You know, the levels that they are right now at about 10%. I mean, that I wouldn't say they, I mean, they still are attractive, but I wouldn't say that they are sort of a doomsday indicating bad things. I think they still have room to come lower, and I think it definitely is a good opportunity for investors to be sitting at and getting 10% within our market. So, yeah, I think there are attractive levels to be invested in, maybe down quite a bit, but I think that where we've sort of try to at present take advantage of this is to sort of maybe not be in the back end of the yield curve investing more risky bonds, but sort of invest in the belly area curve where we get rolled on and carry from these high levels, which we find attractive.
So just finally then, how confident are you about a cut this week?
Mixed, yeah. So I mean, it's probably a 50-50 on our side. The market seems to think that there won't be a cut, looking at Bloomberg consensus. But yeah, I think on our side, it's probably a 50-50 decision. Look, we do not try to make point estimates, but we think that there is scope for them to be cutting rates, given the restrictive nature of where rates are right now.
All right, let's see what happens. And thank you so much for that very insightful analysis, Vishal Rama, quantitative analyst at Prescient Investment Management.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
South Africa's major banks have delivered another solid set of results for the first half of the year. Combined headline earnings up 11% to nearly 70 billion rand. Return on equity 19.5%. Capital ratios among the strongest that we've seen. But obviously these numbers come against a backdrop of domestic weakness, global volatility, rising competition from new entrants and fintechs. So how stable are our banks at this point in time? And what should we expect as we head into the rest of this year and next. To discuss this, I am joined by PwC Major Banks Analysis, Francois Prinsloo, who is the lead in that respect. Francois, a very good morning to you and welcome. On the face of it, 11% headline earnings growth looks impressive. But is it resilience or banks just squeezing harder in a low growth economy?
Yes, we certainly believe the banks have produced a strong and resilient performance in this first half. But as you rightly said, it always should be looked at in the context of the broader operating environment in which these results were achieved. If we look back at the first 6 months of this year, it was certainly a period of intense uncertainty, like you mentioned, geopolitical tension, trade tariffs, foreign currency volatility. And with that, South Africa continued the theme of low economic growth. So it was certainly a challenging environment. On the positive side, the interest rate hiking cycle that we saw not too long ago looks to have abated, and that resulted in lower interest rates compared to what we've seen 2 years ago. So across a range, if we look at the results across a range of measures, we believe it's strong and resilient. If we touch on a couple of the drivers, balance sheets continue to grow very nicely. If you look at the funding side, up 10.6%, and also on the lending side, up 6.4%. What that shows us is that the business and consumer appetite for banking services was very much still there, and that provided the banks with the opportunity to do more with the customers, processing more transactions, take more deposit, extend more credit. And that sort of translated very well into good top-line growth, with operating income growing nearly 7.1%. So overall, strong, resilient financial performance in tough economic circumstances.
But against that backdrop, Francois, margins have also narrowed slightly. Does one read that as an early warning on profitability going forward, or just more competitive pressure from the new players?
Jeremy, you raised two good points there. I think certainly there is significant competition in our market. We've always known that our market is a very competitive environment, and with lots of new entrants coming in, Challenger Bank, financial, other types of institutions that. But the banks have also positioned themselves through their digital journeys and through their innovation to deal with that. So they continue to look to grow. The other aspect to think about, we're also in a reducing interest rate scenario, which also puts some pressure on margins. And we are waiting for the Stats SA inflation numbers to come out and the MPC. And as we know that there's a composite relationship between interest rates and impairment. And that means when rates do come down, bank credit impairments, for instance, don't come down immediately. Although the decrease in interest rates have a positive impact on credit impairment charges in turn. But like you said, it does drag down the interest income, particularly on the interest rate sensitive loans like mortgages and vehicle asset finance. But on the upside, you know, lower interest rates, again, will likely boost some new loan formation. And I think the other bit is general sentiment from consumers and business confidence perspective in the country improves when interest rates fall. So yes, I think there is some interest rate downward cycle does put some pressure, but it also creates some opportunity for the banks.
Francois, importantly, you mentioned digital migration, and it's massive. If I read the report correctly, over 20 million clients now on digital platforms. Is this transformation really starting to lower costs, though, or is there always the overhang of just raising cybersecurity risk?
Jeremy, the banks certainly... all the major banks are continuing on their digital renewal or digital foundation route. You know, they're transitioning and refining their core systems on cloud platforms. They're modernizing payments across Africa. They're unifying systems into single hub. And what it does do, it does deliver some speeds. It does deliver some new products that previously took months can get to market very quickly. It helps with compliance and compliance with local and global standard, and it helps them to be more agile. It also provides some cost benefit, although it's fair to say a lot of the upfront investment is now being done to actually get you through that digital journey. So, yeah, I think we've seen banking to look very different now to compare to what it looked 10 years ago. You know, we're all digital now. If you think about the sort of the digital journey, what we do, what products we get on our mobile phones, the banking channels, the applications, the delivery from the banks look very and feel very different, and I think that journey is going to continue.
And to unpack that report a little further, you also mentioned that generative AI is now creeping into fraud detection and credit scoring. Are our banks leading responsibly, in your opinion, or maybe moving too fast because we know there is a lack of, or at least regulation is not necessarily keeping pace?
Jeremy, there continue to be an exploration and hype in the AI space, with lots of people playing around with AI in various use cases. What we are seeing in areas like data harvesting being used in internal functions, such as, like you referred to, compliance, call center, collection, and fraud detection. So they are very clearly very general case uses, which ultimately can and will drive efficiency and effectiveness. But as with any emerging technology, use cases need to be integrated in a responsible manner. And the banks are very aware of this particular requirement, given the sensitive data and information that they handle and processes. So yes, they are exploring and implementing lots of applications, but we certainly see the sense of appreciation for the significance around personal information and the responsible way in doing it.
And Francois, just a final question, and very quickly, looking to the rest of this year and into 2026, with tariffs, geopolitics, and possible rates cuts in play, or rates cuts in play, what's the single biggest risk, in your opinion, to bank stability that you'll be watching most closely?
Jeremy, the banks will continue to counterbalance immediate challenges, and that includes economic growth, that includes challenging geopolitical environment with growth opportunities. And I know you asked me for one, but there's probably a couple. There's monetary policy normalization. We're seeing further gradual interest rate cuts. We're expecting that. We see data as a strategic asset. You know, the next competitive battleground is who uses data best, who integrates very most effectively with their customer. And then I guess the other bit is what the banks will be focusing on is continued opportunities for large funding. And we see that in energy, we see that in infrastructure, and particularly, I guess, those with a good and a strong Africa footprint, large opportunities around sustainable finance opportunities. And with that, I guess the last point is just the continuation of the digital journey, where we see banks heavily investing, and particularly around Africa as well, around payment opportunities and payment initiatives, where they're partnering and investing significantly.
Thank you very much indeed, Francois Prinsloo, Banking and Capital Markets Lead at PwC Africa.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, this week, you might know, is National Cleanup and Recycle SA Week. But behind cleanup campaigns like this, I think, lies a much tougher question. South Africa generates something in the region of 12 million tons of waste this year. Most of it is plastic, and too much, as you probably well know, ends up in landfills or rivers. So recycling is framed as both an environmental duty and an economic lifeline, but I wonder whether it can really deliver on both fronts. I want to explore that in a little more detail. I'm in conversation now with Patricia Pillay, who's Chief Executive Officer at the recycling company Polyco. Patricia, welcome to you. How serious is South Africa's waste crisis right now, and where do you think it's most visible?
I think we're at a point where we are making progress, but the question is everyone part of the solution? And I think that's where I always question people's will and people's actual conviction, because a lot of people, like this week you'll see National Cleanup and Recycle Week, people will be on the beaches, they will be cleaning up, you know, everyone will be wearing the t-shirts, but what happens after that? So the problem is a serious one. People show or speak about the passion that they have for it, but how sustainable are the solutions? And that's where we as Polyco come in, to look at sustainable solutions.
Of course, the problem, I guess, is that for most South Africans who are dealing with a myriad of other difficulties and challenges, something like pollution and recycling is way down on their list of priorities. That's the problem, isn't it?
100%, and our lives are so busy. I mean, just taking care of ourselves is a problem, leave alone our extended families. But I think that's the message that we try and relay through our education and awareness campaigns, all the way from our school kids, all the way to adults and just citizens and wonderful programs like yours, is to say it's in the little things we do. Often we feel it's these big things that we have to do, but it's small, simple things. And it starts in the home. It starts with yourself. So I believe that whether it's to do with recycling, whether it's to do with waste, whether it's to do with water, it's small little changes that are going to make the difference. And that's what we're finding with our projects.
I absolutely acknowledge what you're saying, but I'd come right back at you, Patricia, and say that municipalities play a vital role in all of this. And the problem is that many don't run basic collection properly, and therein lies a big problem, surely.
Oh, you are really stressing something that we all need to be, well, I think we're all aware of it, and we all need to think of how do we solve for this without, I think, with accepting the reality, like you're saying. And it's true, when we just hear the budget speeches, etc., and then you meet with the municipalities, all of them will say, I don't have the budget, I don't have the resources, or I need trucks, or my trucks are not working to go out and collect, or a very reality in South Africa, it's too dangerous to go into that area to collect. So what we look at now is to get citizens and communities, that very area and that community that you live in, what can you do to work and collaborate with the municipality? And that overused phrase, public-private partnerships that we talk about, but putting it into action. And I can give you a quick example. We're working with the city of Cape Town at the moment, and one of the aldermen that we're working with, Grant Twigg, who has come up with the community-led waste minimization program in one of the vulnerable communities, where we've said to the community, look, you have a gap here. You're not getting pickup and collections, but let us start working on creating this green economy in your area, because you can't continue to say it's not happening, we don't have the services. And we then, as the producer responsibility organizations with other donors, etc., are working now with the municipality as well to start looking at collecting recyclables from door to door with the volunteers from the community. So I think that you have to solve together. I think that's the point that I'm making, and it's people like us who have to steer that with along the municipality and Cape Town.
I'm glad you used the word volunteers, because part of the problem, I would imagine, is recycling is often seen as a charity and not necessarily part of the or mainstream part of the economy.
Yes, and I think that for me, that perception needs to change. In this particular project that I mentioned, the community volunteers are there for the cleanups, etc. But part of the education is about the value of the waste. And I can give you also another example of our flagship packaging. Most rural communities to urban communities, entrepreneurs from that very community can earn livelihoods and actually start a entire career, start creating jobs from waste. So in 2024 alone, 16,000 new jobs were created just from waste. And these were people who had no jobs. And through education, through training, by giving them the infrastructure and resources, they were able to then feed their families and send their kids to school. I mean, we're sitting in where are we now? September already, wow. And we're sitting on a figure of just over 18,000 just already this year. And this is now, I'm talking new jobs. So there's definitely an economy. There's the green economy that we talk about, but it's about actually implementing projects where it's no longer about waste is something of no use and value. There is a circular economy. It's just about making people aware of the value.
Thank you very much indeed. That's Patricia Pillay, who's Chief Executive Officer at the recycling company Polyco.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, artificial intelligence is often sold as a threat to jobs, but is that really the case? Here in South Africa, it's now being pitched as the opposite, a chance to create new industries and new employment. Google is backing local founders with cash and mentorship. But my question is, can AI really solve this country's big jobs crisis, or is it just a whole lot of hype? Joining me now is Folarin Aigbusi, who is a startup developer at Google. Folarin, a very warm welcome to you. Why does Google see South Africa as the right place to back AI founders? What's your thinking?
I actually love the question, right? The way we think about Africa is we think about Africa in terms of hubs, right? We see where there's critical innovation, we see that where there's most opportunity, and the nice intersects between that critical innovation and opportunity is hubs like the South Africa, Kenya, Nigeria, Egypt, Ghana, and one or two other places, right? So when I think about the question you ask, I think the response there is that the critical innovation, especially with things like artificial intelligence and machine learning, right, the opportunities that the government is creating, if anything. The third thing is the innovations we've seen from enterprise, right, make for a wonderful melting pot of opportunity, right, for us to then come in and support the more early stage tech startups to play a role or contribute to whether it's job creation, revenue generation, or even bringing in inflows, foreign investments into the country, right, which is part of why we think about running a South Africa-specific accelerator program.
So that's the broad canvas, but realistically, what kind of jobs can AI create here, and maybe more importantly, how quickly?
Sure. You know, that there's the conversation around, okay, AI taking the jobs, but a quote I've held onto for quite some time is this, right, is that AI is not going to take jobs. It's the people that understand how to leverage AI or use AI that are going to take the jobs, if anything. So when I think about the jobs that are created, think about the way when we had the mobile phone, right, enter the markets, when we had the internet enter the markets, right, we went from whether it's the people that would deliver the letters, for example, deliver letters from the post office, right? We went from that to faster communication via mobile phone, via the internet. We went to voice over internet, right? Whether it was Skype, whether it was all these different online services and the rest, right? When I think about AI as well, what it does is create opportunity for more productive roles, more higher productivity roles, if anything, more creative roles in terms of the arts and the creative economy, if anything, more tech to be enabled. It allows us build and ship faster, build better and ship faster. Mm. So when you think about, and I'll give one classic example is this, right? It's actually from a startup that we supported in last year's cohort of the South Africa Accelerator Program. It's a startup called Botale AI, right? When you think about banking the unbanked and banking those in the remote areas, usually maybe like our parents, right? Our moms and our dads, who would usually speak our local languages and not have English as their first language. What then happens if you're presenting an English-based platform to them? It's that they still cannot use these platforms. They still don't understand how to leverage platforms like this. And what that means is that they are not financially included, right? But with a platform like this one, for example, where they are bringing local languages to financial services or local languages to other services, that allows for those that are historically disadvantaged or historically unbanked to then start to think about leveraging these platforms. So again, to answer the question, is that AI creates jobs and an avenue for people that would usually be disadvantaged or disregarded to then play a role with technology, to then interact with technology.
And I do acknowledge a very good example there, and I would imagine the difficulty or the challenge going forward is to stop AI innovation from staying in elite tech circles and not, as you've illustrated to me, reaching ordinary people.
Exactly that. It's that the truth is Africa as a whole, and then South Africa, has an opportunity to leapfrog our peculiar challenges, right? When we've talked about tech historically, we've seen that it's been the global West and then Africa. It's been that it's only one or two solutions that have gone on to be so innovative because of our peculiar situation that they've been recognized globally. And one of those, for example, is mobile money, right? But AI presents a level playing field where this was sprung up on a lot of us, right? All at the same time. So now we all have the same opportunity to pick up on learnings, to play with the different platforms, to build different solutions, leveraging AI, and see how we can solve for our challenges, whether it's, again, banking the unbanked, whether, again, it's getting education to the most remote of areas, whether it's getting healthcare solutions to the most remote of areas, if anything. And when you think about, again, let me use another example, actually. It's, we say we have over 1.3 billion people in Africa, right? Our healthcare services, for example, our social, our public infrastructure cannot support the populations that we have. So we have to get creative with thinking about how to solve for those people that would usually be displaced or remote or removed from public services, if anything. And that's where you bring in AI. It's that we can leverage AI for simple things such as, on one hand, whether it's the immediate quick service consultation, right? Quick service consultation, it's different kinds of learning opportunities in your palm, at your hands, as opposed to having to go in school, right, and walk a couple of kilometers to meet a school and meet teachers that are very few and far between, if anything. It's finding these creative solutions for our peculiar challenges.
My parents always used to say to me, Fallerin, never look a gift horse in the mouth. And I do acknowledge the work that you're doing in that respect. But I wonder if R1 million in equity-free funding is enough in South Africa to build competitive companies.
The truth is, I have two answers for that, Jeremy, right? You know, R1 million is a lot, but it's also not a lot, right? And but even if it were 10 million we're giving the startups, we could easily see that that is a lot, but it's not a lot. Even if we're 100 million we're giving the startups, it would be like, that's a lot, but it's not a lot, right? And that's because we need to understand context, right? The funding we give the startups, we think of it as proof of concept to say, look, hey, we are a trillion-dollar company. We're multinational. We believe in what you're building, right? Here is proof. We're putting our money where our mouth is, and we're showing you that we believe in what you're building. Here is this token amount to help you keep going. That's the first thing. The second thing is, when you think about the entrepreneurs, the standard African entrepreneurs' journey, it's that we're all in survival mode when we're entrepreneurs. So we have to worry. We live pocket to mouth. We have to worry about not just our own paycheck, but paychecks of people that we're feeding, that we're housing as our staff. We have to worry about our virtual rents for the platforms that we're building. We have to worry about the physical rent, in fact, for the startup and for ourselves, and much more, if anything. What these amounts help the startups do is worry less about their immediate needs. So it's R1 million, but it helps you say, you know what, take your mind off your virtual. It's also not just R1 million. It's R1 million. It's also cloud credits. Almost $200,000 worth of cloud credits. So what we say there is that, hey, take your mind off worrying about virtual rents for now. Take your mind off worrying about paying some salaries for a month or two or three or four or five, right, for now. Take your mind off your immediate needs and focus on building, right? What this amount then does is allow them shift that focus to building scalable solutions. It then also then helps them raise follow-on funding from the more institutional investment vehicles, whether it's like venture capital, or others, friends and family, or more, which then brings in the bigger amounts of money that help them scale even further and even into new markets.
Thank you very much for talking to me today. That is Fallerin Ayagbusi, who is a startup developer at Google. And that's where we're going to leave it. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We're here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.